So thank you very much, both of you, for bringing the exhibition to contemporary questions, and also one hand to you, to your talk, James. But the really, I found it really good just to mention this kind of that the longue durée is not only a longue durée in the term but this is always kind of in a way reconstructed by reclaiming also political or being constituted as a political subjects by question of struggle and claiming for indigenous rights. So this is not only that we know that the indigenous is not a term which just exists all the time, but is reconstituted in a way what Sylvester yesterday has said, that a certain local in Nigeria, certain local traditions have to be kind of claimed and have to be you have to fight for it in order to make them real. And then the other hand, Kerstin's talk, which was very very challenging in the same respect, in the way you both have identified any question of escape, primitivizing, turning back, even either to the primitive or to the class in the form of an idealistic, as an idealistic notion. So my question, since you, in a way, what I found interesting, in a way, both of your talks, and since we're sitting here in exhibition space, Congress Hall, both of you dealt with the museum. You didn't mention the museum as a frame in which everything is happening. But on the other hand, you showed Luna's piece, which is great, but at the same time, I think it's also a bit sad because you see the necessity of still struggling with that kind of form of subjectivation or subjection, actually. So my question would be, is this another part of a contradiction, or how would you put it that everything, the heterogeneity of times, the heterochronies, the materialism against idealism, in a way happens within a more or less idealistic framework, which is the museum? Or would you reject that?
I think what I find interesting in Einstein's writing in Fabrikation der Fiktion is one of the things, when you look at other texts of the same period, which also go on to disgrace intellectualism and mostly other intellectuals, like Hugo Ball's text or Breton or Bataille for that, when they go on and insult one another. They go on and insult one another. It's you do it wrong. And it's naming them. It's going there and saying this is the wrong position and it's you and I identify you as it. And that's something Einstein does not do to anyone other than himself. Mm-hmm. There are names, there are Dali footnotes and Picasso footnotes and so on. But it's not as much as Fabrikation der Fiktion is extremely personal. This is personal, a personal attack. It's not a personal attack which is identifying its other. And this is why I know it's kind of absurd to bring Henrike Naumann in relation to that. But this is also very much an attack, but not even this is a personalized attack, but the question is more, and this is why I find this shift in materialist perspective interesting. It's not saying we have to think from the institutions and we have to think from the forms of institutions and criticize them and open them and so forth, which is an important labor, absolutely. And, trying it in art history and so on, but but then I would say this is not the political radical labor, but to look at it to try to misuse aesthetic forms or to try to misuse art, to use artistic productions not to find out something about art but to find out something against art and to find out something against politics and not to be productively immersed in politics and make them better, because politics which are based on the on the Hegelian subject are not like, they could be a bit better, but they could not be good because the, yeah, so, yeah. Blah, blah.
Well, the whole museum context is, of course, very apt and apropos. And I'm tempted to say, don't get me started. Because actually my current project, if I can be said to have a project, really does have to do with the legacy of the ethnological museum, Anthropologic Volkerkunde, whatever you want to call it, museum, in the 21st century. The stories that those collections told and the practices that they represented in the 20th century arguably simply don't work anymore in the 21st, or shouldn't, and there's a lot of pressure. There is pressure being felt from different quarters on those museums and what I call the successor institutions to those museums. I consider the Quai Branly in Paris a successor institution to an ethnological museum. The Humboldt Forum here would be another one. And many of the ethnology museums are rebranding themselves museums of world arts and cultures. This is a very common thing. Actually, there's a kind of hegemony of art over artifact that is an interesting trend to follow. But the museum is an epitome and a crystallization of a certain world systemic colonial and commodifying way of processing the world. And it's contested, and it's also very powerful, and there are a lot of very strong interests who are committed to sustaining it and to marketing it. We see, I consider it a very important area of struggle today. I was having just talking before we came here with Clémentine Delis, who's over there, who has really been a leader in thinking about these post-ethnographic museums and really pushing hard on against the constraints that continue to form them. And I think that things are changing, but they're changing in very uneven and slow ways, and it depends a lot where you are. If you're in Canada now or in Australia, you don't do anything with respect to either First Nations or Aboriginal art without serious participation from tribal people. It's just not possible. And that's in part because those people are nearby, and it's also part because they have mobilized a cultural politics that of shame and of counter history that have made it very difficult to proceed with museums in the old way. And I also will say that many people working in the museums are genuinely interested in becoming more post-colonial, whatever that means. And maybe it's that place you never get to, but you keep trying to move that way. And there are a lot of really creative and interesting people working in museums today, in these ethnological museums. So as I go around to them, I'm sort of doing inventorying all that. It's a very uneven picture, and it, again, very much depends where you are. I'm here in part to find out what the latest is on the Humboldt Forum. It's a big story, but it's not the only story, you may be relieved to know. kind of respond to your question.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Another question I have, and then I think a lot of you will have a lot of questions as well. For me, it was interesting to hear, let me put it differently, like, you were very optimistic, and when you were very optimistic, you were more using like a metaphor of, it will pass. So with the metaphor of the storm, it will vanish. And then I was wondering, I mean, yes and no. But then the question is, again, how you do you interfere in the storm? Or and which brings me to the question, like, if we think every like fantasy about going back somewhere, I mean, it's still very valid today as well, because we see how destructive global capitalism works with all the examples you mentioned. But then that any idea of going back somewhere is another, like the reverse function of capitalist time, because it's progressing and then you think reverse. So when you say that there is something to learn from the indigenous, is there something you would say which is outside of the frame of like progressing, making the world better, or going back? So it's kind of, you cannot frame it within like, yeah, the capitalist time, which is kind of colonizing time.
There's nothing outside that frame anywhere. So let's just start from that assumption. So then the question is, what can happen inside that? Inside slash out. There are ways of being inside and outside and crossing that border, you know, of being partly in and partly out of the capitalist world system. Or I don't believe that historical temporality or even directionality of history is a capitalist plot. I think that I will take a sort of ontological stand about that and get into trouble with my ethnocentrism by doing it. But I feel that I do think you have to cop to your ethnocentrism if you want to enter into real translation relations. If you don't really confront what you really think, but you like to sort of entertain alternate realities, but not really take them seriously, then you're not being honest. So I think we're always operating within these systems of power, hegemonic systems, sometimes brutally dominant, sometimes in Gramscian sense hegemonic, in other words, contestable, through alliance politics, politics of articulation. We really have to think about very specific circumstances. And if we're very quick to say, oh, well, it's all, everything, you can look at anything and see that it will be co-opted or commodified. If it has any value, it will be commodified. But that's not the end of the story. That's one thing that happens to culture. It's one thing that happens to objects. But other things can also happen at the same time. And we have to be able to see several things at once, several processes at once. And that's why we need those multiple stories. We always have to be telling more than one story. If we're always seeing that the world system and capitalism winning out, then we're basically just, it's a failure of imagination, I think, really. And I have very little patience with that view anymore. It makes you feel very high, you know, nicely critical, and you can see through everything, but you're basically reconfirming in a negative mode a Western view of the world. The West and its successor sites are all powerful. Well, that's colonialism. That's imperialism, and we need to struggle out of that. And without, you know, being Pollyanna optimism. I'm often accused of being optimistic, because I allow even the possibility of resistance and subversion. And people say, well, it's much more comfortable to be all just constantly critical. And I think that I've gotten over that. I think that you have to be critical, but you also have to be open, and you have to also be hopeful. How can you have politics without hope? So it may be a chastened hope. It may be a partial kind of hope. But anyway, that's my profession of faith.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think, I mean, like, even if, my paper didn't sound very hopeful, but I would still say I would totally agree, where you sort of like brought the argument from now to say, like, we need the specificity, like, we need to, like, there is a need for specificity, and to speak about global capital from global capital is just a problem of measure. It's like, it's a problem of scale. It's speaking in the scale of capital and deducing one's own criticism from the scale of capital, which I would say, which is already what Einstein goes up against. So there's a question coming. And And that is, I was when I first read the Fabrication der Fiktion, this constant use of immediacy was really, really, really annoying me, because it's like, yeah, it has a very weird tone today. But then, I mean, if one thinks about what you said about being specific and thinking history, or also even thinking capitalization and the possibility of decapitalization as being specific, how would you, like, do you think, because I thought, like, maybe there is even a relation to something like immediacy, in something like an Adornian sense, when, like, Adorno says immediacy is never the beginning, but can only be an end. Mm-hmm. Would you say, like, what's your relation to immediacy? I know. It's a cheesy one.
Look, I'm as good a post-structuralist as anybody, so immediacy, no, you know, you reach for your deconstructor right away, or your semiotic weapons, you know. I don't like immediacy. I don't know what it means. It would depend. I don't know the Einstein work you're talking about, so it's really hard for me to say anything good about it. I do think there are times to suspend defamiliarization, to suspend the Entfremdungs effect, and to actually go with the flow a little bit. We need to be able to, I mean, listening is an important thing, and in listening, I think there's ways of being a critical listener, but the actual act of listening is, I think, a receptive form, and I think that we all need to do more of that. And for me, you know, the emergence, just becoming aware and grappling with the presence of indigeneity today, of the vast diversity of indigenous societies. And by the way, not all good. I mean, indigeneity is a problematic category, and especially in places like Africa, it's often a source of mischief. It's, you know, because indigeneity basically says we were here before you. Indigeneity is a politics of priority, and if in Africa, if everybody is native in some sense, then, you know, in Rwanda, the Hutus will kill the Tutsis because calling them invaders, immigrants, outsiders. You know, we know that indigeneity and nativism can slide into each other. We know this. So I think it's a very ambivalent and powerful concept. But what makes me want to take it seriously in a positive vein is that, especially in those settler colonial places, where in recent time the invasion is very apparent. You know exactly who the invader was, and they were genuine outsiders, and what they did was extremely, and is still extremely destructive. And if the people who have come through and are in some sense survivors, and more than survivors now, active agents, historical agents in those countries, I'm not willing to condemn them for bad essentialism, or, you know, or for being too, a little bit too nationalistic at times. As long as they don't have an army and a police force, things like that, I'll cut them some slack. Because I think, as I said before, the fact that these folks are still here is a big historical surprise. You know, there was no one in Einstein's time who really believed this was possible. Mm. You know, Max Weber, remember modernization? Like all those big ideas that were these one-way streets. It's more complicated than that, it's turned out. History is not a single line.
Mm. Okay. So I already have questions.
Sorry.
Don't I?
Thank you very much for your three stories at once, and for the multiple stories also concerning indigeneity, because I was just going to ask if indigeneity is a question of scale, and also of question of referring to former settler colonies more than to any other colonies. So that in settler colonies, of course, you can say primitivism has gone, but then indigenous people have been there all the time. And nevertheless, I mean, we in comparing scales and comparing continents, of course, we would say indigeneity and ancestry are very ambivalent terms. So if you have ancestry and indigenous movements in nation states, of course, they can be, as you said, murderous or even poisonous. But let me just ask one question, if that fits with the reality of indigenous communities in settler colonies too. For example, what do you think of genetic tests, of course, concerning the membership of indigenous communities? Because otherwise, they might... ancestry, which was not there before, ancestry was adoption, ancestry was alliance, ancestry was kinship, was based not on ancestry. Many of these communities, so it has been turned around also by ethnic categories and maybe nation states developments. So maybe there is an ambivalence there even in between the scaling of indigenous and the ancestry communities.
Well, I absolutely agree with the I certainly agree with the direction of your comment question. I think genetic testing is a pseudo-scientific form of governmentality, of producing insiders and outsiders in tribes today, which is can be very destructive. But even before they had genetic testing, the idea of blood and blood quantum, those requirements, was doing the same kind of work, because kinship is more complicated than blood. It, as you said, it often involves adoption, it involves people living a long time in a place who may not have the definable ancestry, but are very much part of a community. And many tribal indigenous societies, you know, have much more flexible ways of determining who belongs and who doesn't belong. Along comes genetic testing, and all sorts of people start arriving and saying, well, I'm one of you because, look, I have all this ancestry, and here's the documented historical, quantifiable historical evidence. And in some tribes, especially in my state of California, where tribes run gambling casinos, many of them, this leads to great mischief and often the expulsion of certain people who have lived very long times in those communities, and the qualification of outsiders based on this specious reified quantum of belonging. So these are ways, you know, and you know, tribal peoples have done some. There are some very bad stories of tribes excluding folks. The Cherokee Friedman story: the Cherokee excluded African Americans who were had been part of the tribe for generations. And the Cherokees, as you probably know, are in Oklahoma now, but they came from the Southeast. From Georgia originally, and actually many of them were slaveholders back then. Anyway, there were African Americans in the tribe, and recently many of those African Americans were racially cleansed from the tribe in really very problematic and ugly ways. So we're not dealing with saints. We're dealing with real regular people who can do bad things, and if you have a tribe or a community, there's going to be a politics of inside and outside, and those are often ugly politics. My optimism is a tempered optimism, but at least I've said what I said. But thank you for the question. It's a good corrective. But many people will, there are plenty of horror stories about every community, and you find one or two, and then you get to dismiss the whole phenomenon. And that's where I say, wait a minute, that's where specificity is required.
Okay, thank you. Questions, more questions?
Sorry.
Okay,
Thank you very much for raising lots of questions. And this is going to be a very uncooked question. But while you were talking, I noticed the drums from the counter-protest. And so, of course, the drum and the drumming brings up the issue of the notion of the tribal brought into Europe. And, of course, the reason that there was this drumming outside, I assume, though correct me if I'm wrong, is because it's counter-protests to an argument for indigeneity in Germany. And so, and we are in a museum.
Sure, yeah.
And, of course, you're talking about the issue of the inside and the outsides of museums. And so I don't have a conclusion to this question. I don't have a grand statement about it. But it just, the ironies seem to be building as I was listening to you talking about tribal things, and I was listening to the mimic of tribalism as a counter-protest against an argument for indigeneity. And I was wondering if there's any way of bringing this even more into the present tense by talking about sort of the ways in which indigeneity are being used today and manipulated today as a protective move against the perceived power of the other, even when the other is probably not all that powerful, and when the indigenous is not all that indigenous, nor is it all that threatened.
Kerstin already has a question, like an answer, like a comment.
No,
yeah.
Because I was
thinking of the Henrike Naumann works, the Reichsbürger would surely love to think of themselves as indigenous. But just because they would, that doesn't make them that. I mean, like, I would say, like, I would not even, like, I was thinking about that, and then I thought, like, no, I'm not going to talk about it, because otherwise one starts naming it that way, and one starts having the discourse around it, and I think that discourse, like, that discourse should just simply not happen, because, yeah, I mean, racism is not an opinion, it's a crime, and this is, like, a community of crime, and I don't, yeah, so, sorry.
Thank you for bringing that deep irony into the conversation. I can't make it go away. but it is true that indigenism is a kind of global discourse. I mean, that phrase, you see it a lot more, and it isn't only formerly colonized or tribal peoples or First Nations peoples who use it. I just read recently a thing, and this was something on the good side of the ledger for genetic testing. there are movements in Britain who are very active in the Brexit campaign, who consider indigenous Britons Anglo-Saxons. You know, the whole category of Anglo-Saxon is what you have to be if you're going to be an indigenous. They use that language, an indigenous English person, and genetic testing has shown that these indigenous, that Anglo-Saxons were very hybrid, very complicated, came from many, many different traditions, and had no coherent or single bloodline at all. And this won't stop anyone from claiming that, but at least it, yeah. But the discourse of indigeneity is global, and it's become very, very powerful, and all sorts of people use it now as a way of protecting themselves from outsiders. It's become related to a kind of nativism that's based in scapegoating. I'm cynical about community. I think all communities, if they feel threatened, will turn to the scapegoat. I think that's a very universal. I almost never say anything's universal, but I'll almost go so far as to say that. And so that's a sad, sad comment. But indigeneity is very much a part of that, that whole problematic.
Okay, I already have four questions, so maybe please keep your questions short.
You should ask the questions, and then we won't talk. Right? Let's hear what you guys have to say.
Anselm. Okay, I caught you. Then behind Zairong, you have a question? Yeah.
Thank you will, I think just to add to that, I just wonder, and I wonder what you say, and I think you already answered that to a certain extent. I don't think the concept of indigeneity can be really reconciled with supremacy. And this is where I think maybe we have to be, we have to really kind of be very aware that that notion of indigeneity by supremacist movements is hijacked, because they do not fit the declaration, they do not fit the definition of the Declaration of the Indigenous Rights as a settler, as being dominated, as being without land, as being and so on. So they hijack it. In a way, they articulate it, almost in a sense by Stuart Hall. They take part of it and lock it in with something else. It's really the Stuart Hall's articulation, but it does not mean what it means to be indigenous in a settler society. And I think I just wanted, it was just burning in me, sorry. It was just more a comment than a question,
yeah.
Really.
Okay. No, but thanks. So I can just pass the mic.
It's probably also just a comment, maybe a kind of question in the end, if I arrive there. So, James, you talk about the surprise, right? The historical surprise. And also from yesterday's talk and some kind of other, actually, just now, the question also, I would say it's a historical irony, right? That it always kind of... it's almost a bit funny that for a long time, so yesterday, I think it was Joy's comment, that the suddenly we find out the ancient Greeks painted their sculptures with tacky colors. Mm-hmm. Suddenly we find out that this and that. Maybe if I can ask a kind of something that would always puzzle me is the present tense that... somehow there's always a feeling whenever as scholar, especially when we talk at the present tense, we feel we are finally right. Somehow. We're critically reflecting on history and how these people have done things wrong. And there's a sense of we arrived at the point of better understanding. That's, of course, very dangerous and problematic, and that comment, I think, is very interesting to juxtapose the kind of what is happening here and the other time that is happening outside, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a general question. What do you think of this and how...
Thank you, Zairong. Actually, this is a bit like the question that I have on my mind. So I think I'll ask the question in terms of ancestors. I think, James, you actually mentioned at one point the Australian women who evoke their ancestors' art forms in the contemporary art format. So ancestor worship is part of the primitivist trope. Right? So Einstein was guilty of that in Negaplastic. Of course, he thought that the African will become the ancestor, right? And I hear this still a lot, that so and such cultures venerate their ancestors. And I think, if I can speculate, this projection that other cultures have practiced some kind of ancestor worship is actually another word, a way of saying ahistorical. Something, so I think Sylvester's talk earlier was talking about this, the tendency to project Africans by Europeans as timeless people, right? So in some ways, I don't think the idea of ancestral worship is free from that. At the same time, I think the kind of maybe the mishap is that I know that Maria here is a specialist about the traditional writing history, right? So I'm really grateful that, James, you propose more creative ways of thinking about history. So there is history as evolution, which means you always overcome the past, whatever past phase it is. There's also history as a kind of chronicle of great words and deeds by people, then there was this war, which is actually a little bit, when you reminded us of that kind of way of telling history, that's another way of telling history. I think it's absolutely right. And in fact, Hannah Arendt talks about this when her critique of this modern historical consciousness, which is very different from the ancient idea of history, which is actually you tell the stories of one hero who triumphed in this battle, won the city for us, you know, that kind of classical way of thinking about history. So I guess my question can also be related to the museum, because in some ways it's not correct that Europeans always want to kill their ancestors. I don't think that's correct, because the moment you walk into a European museum, which is a European institution in its outset, you see that actually there's a very strange way in which the Europeans, Western Europeans, who authored this evolutionary way of thinking about history, actually do venerate their ancestors in a certain way, right? So I think that's maybe also a creative way of thinking about museums, that is a way to rewrite history, right? Just a comment.
Yeah, do you want to respond to any of that, or
jump on any of that? I would just only say that I think it's hard for me to imagine any society that doesn't some way have to deal with its prior generations, its social past, and venerating or worshiping ancestors is one way to say it, but I do know I can think of societies where those verbs wouldn't work too well. I mean, ancestors can be really dangerous and irritating, and you spend a lot of time either avoiding them or feeding them, or just getting them to leave you alone. These are. I'm thinking Melanesia now. But I'm sure those are not the only places. But as I say, I think any society has to deal with the question of history and heroes. For what it's worth, I mean, my PhD is in history. I'm not an anthropologist. I was trained in history in the 1970s, and my hero was E.P. Thompson, Edward Thompson. Making of the English working class, and this was the moment of bottom-up history, and these were the people who had no voice in the historical record, who had suffered from the great condescension, as he put it, of history, and his archival project and political project was to give voice to these nameless artisans, and that's very inspiring to me. And that's one. It's not the only way to do history, but it's certainly an important way. And then, women's history followed that, and women's anthropology. Anthropology, oh my God, when it suddenly became apparent in the 1960s that all of those anthropological accounts of Trobriand societies or whoever it might be, actually in some of them, quite a few of them written by women, like Margaret Mead, were really mostly about men, and sometimes exclusively about men, and they somehow represented whole cultures without paying attention to half of the population. And you say, well, okay, why was that? Did they just not get around to it? Or maybe they didn't notice those people? No. They came into visibility for political reasons. It wasn't a scientific thing where you... First you study this group, then you study this group, and it all adds up to a whole picture. No, it was the politics of knowledge, and it was second wave feminism that made it apparent suddenly that all those classic ethnographies were male-focused. And so history is always about, for me, always about the excluded. I mean, Walter Benjamin is a powerful exponent of blasting things out of the continuum of the received history to make room for something else that's in there in the record, but hasn't found voice, hasn't found representation. So anyway, that's always my my view of history. There was some other things, but maybe I should stop.
Yeah. Well, Kerstin has one more comment, and then I have two questions. Please be brief in your questions, because we have to leave the room in 5 minutes.
History.
Time limits, periodizations.
Yeah, speaking of periodizations, I mean, I think this is a bit like the question I would have in relation to what Joy said, or like also in relation to quite a few discussions at the conference, because one of the questions, and it's a question which has been posed again and again here, is when does history start? Because like, does like not history in, and like I'm not talking about Vor- und Frühgeschichte, sorry, prehistory, but what I mean is, because you were saying like women's history and so forth, and that like, so does history of something start when it becomes a science, or does history start when it becomes a social movement, or does, because like for example Benjamin, for all that he's worth, like Lou Merton wasn't what he was going to quote. Lou Merton, a historian, an art historian of his time, wasn't what he's going to quote. And Lou Merton, for example, wrote an art history which was free of heroism and free of salvaging big individuals from the past, but more about thinking about a constant prehistory of production, of like collectivity in production. And so I would say like this question of when do certain strands of discussion start? I think, for example, if we look at sexuality and if we look at like countering hegemonic binary gender models, then looking at something like the turn of the last century, at least if you look at Europe, is actually much more productive to a way to start history, because then you can look at instances of unmodern sexuality, whereas when one goes to it became a social movement in the 60s and it became a science in the 70s, then one is already bound to the modern categories entirely. And can only free oneself from them and not say, well, they're not also modern to start with. So I think this question of where to look forward and backwards.
Okay, we have a question over here. And then Tom. Maybe we collect the questions and...
Okay. I would just also want to add to that discussion that we had earlier about the problematics of the term of indigeneity, and I was wondering whether it not has to do with the absence of the idea of mobility in the dominant reading of indigeneity, and I the way I read your work, James, and we have been discussing that earlier here in the European Anthropology Department, is that you try actually also bring that together, because your another major subject of your work is the diaspora and the combination of roots and roots with a different writing. So my question actually would be whether this also from an academic discourse co-produced kind of idea of indigeneity being the opposite to mobility creates some of the problems that we've been discussing. Because it's always seen as different things, and people can use it to actually feel or argue against migration and so on. Yeah. So, yeah, that's my question.
I mean, quickly, I'm somehow deviating from this mainstream of discussion right now. Just a question to Kerstin. I sensed in your talk, I mean, because it's such a crucial category, that of the metamorphic, metamorphism, also, as I understand you, is as a term, as a category, as a concept that is extremely of extreme contemporary, or could be of extreme contemporary value. How do I have to understand the kind of split notion of metamorphism in Einstein's Fabrikation der Fiktion and in your reading of it? Since there's, on the one hand, there's this kind of critical reading of the metamorphic as being, I mean, almost homologous to capitalism and to the kind of liquidification of social relationships, etc. Mana equals money, etc. And on the other hand, there's this more, I don't know, it's not an affirmative, of course, but it's a way of, or take on the metamorphic, but a different of dimension of the metamorphic, which has this kind of strange revolutionary or whatever a deep materialist effect, possibly. I mean, it's so how would you draw the line or between these two metamorphisms?
I wouldn't. I think sort of like the very consequential thing happening in Fabrikation der Fiktion is exactly that the line is given up, that you have the metamorphotic as at the same time an idealistic, like speaking in terms of capital, an idealistic self-perpetuation of what is given in all its fictitiousness, or like in all its in all its fiction, but nevertheless the same concept where it is a materialist, where it has a materialist traction, or where it has an immediacy, or where it, like, to go through all those terms which Einstein uses, spirals into another direction. And I think this is why the collective, or this is why collectivity appears so often in Fabrikation der Fiktion, because only a collectivity and only an understanding of labor, not as labor, but as joint metabolism and so forth, a bit like in Lou Merton, can sort of, only in that way there is a becoming conscious, or like a consciousness that can materialize itself in these relations. And this is why I said, like, this is why I very briefly referred to Mach, because I would say this is exactly a materialism which doesn't draw the line anymore, because it doesn't call capitalism an ideology, which you can separate yourself from because you can expand on its totality, but it's a fiction. And so it's a fiction one is living, like it's a fictitious thought. So,
okay. So thank you everyone again. I mean, Tom and Anselm. You want to have a last word, Tom and Anselm?
Quickly, to thank everyone, those of you who attended partially or the entire time. It was such a great and intense, and throughout the tension in the room, was marvelous, and all the kind of circumstances surrounding this building, it's notwithstanding. We would like to thank you. We would like to thank all the contributors, the speakers, and we would like to thank again, and namely, please, and please stay with us for this minute. We would like to thank the team of the Bereich für Bildende Kunst here at HKW, namely Agnes Wegner, Chiara Marchini, Susanne Förster, Dunja Salles, Ananda Semel, and others I probably have forgot. We would like to thank the interpreters, the translators, Silvia Schreiber and Matthias Jensen, for their terrific work throughout these 2 days. We would like to thank Tassos Papiomitoglou, André Schulz and Klaus Tabert, who took care of audio and video technology. Thank you very much. The light and stage technology was provided by Leonardo Rende and Benjamin Brandt, and the film team, namely Ralf Klingelhöfer and team, and the team of Buch and Dehn. Thank you very much.
We would like to thank you.